Actually, there looks like there's more people here than when I was sitting over in the corner. Appreciate your presence. Very much impressed by your willingness to worship with the saints. And for those visiting with us, we are encouraged by your presence here. We hope we can be an encouragement to you. Before we get into the sermon, we usually go through some of the classes, but Joe asked me to add also that not only is the building cleaning list a little bare in the last of the year, so is the sign up for preachers for the end of month presentations, and also think about signing up as a teacher for the adult class as we move into Exodus. One of the things, you know, that is often pointed out is you learn a lot more as a teacher or a preacher. If you just do the classes, you know, fill out the blanks, whatever, or some of the reading, it's not as much as if you have to give a presentation, you have to prepare the research, you have to present questions, maybe an overhead. You put a lot more into it and you get a lot more out of it. So I encourage you, you know, if it's possible and you'd like to do that, to sign up for, you know, some of the classes we have available. Amendments to things that are going on already. The memory work sessions are still ongoing. Because we have lost a few, we can move it into, like we did this morning, move it into the office so we sit around the conference table and do those sessions. So remember, don't have to go to the annex, just go to the office. The Worthy Women in Training, Candy, okay, Lori, yeah, that's still going on. It's a good thing for the young ladies. So get them involved in that. And that's after services Sunday morning. You also have, the Olsons, they've kind of, this one's put off till the end of the summer. Some of the classes are going to be done because so many people are gone. Kara told me this morning that they're moving that or, you know, postponing it till, you know, when more people get back. Also, the Christian Family Foundation series under the same thing, that's been put off till the end of the summer. Carol Reeves Home Study, Lady Bible Study, that's still going on? Okay, so that's a go Thursdays at 1 o'clock. Critical Studies in Islam is still ongoing, Saturday mornings at 9, and it's alternating with the Greek class, which is also at 9 o'clock, and it's the Greek class that's this Saturday. And I encourage you to look at the handouts for those that are attending. We're basically going to be covering the cases of Greek, but it's kind of all over the place, maybe even in two books. Not only the basics, but also the Beyond the Basics, you know, book all, as well, to get a little bit more in-depth into it. So look after those. For this morning, we're in the second of a three-part series on the awesome sacrifice of the Son of God. That's this handout book that we've been going through. And we've already looked at, as you can see on the cover, we started off with the arrest of Jesus and looking at if Jesus didn't want to be arrested, there's no way they could have. He often exhibited the ability to walk away from his enemies, you know, without much trouble at all, if it wasn't his time. And even when it was his time, yeah, he shows us that still it's not just that God would allow him to go. Were a very impressive display of power. All those, and they were many that came out to arrest him, had to take a step back and fell to the ground, you know, before he would allow them to even touch him. So we've gone through that, and the illegal processing he's already been through. The rest of Jesus was totally illegal. It was at night. He was arrested before there were any charges. The ones conducting it didn't have the power to do what they were doing, and so it was illegal all the way. And that kind of brings us up to part C of the handout, because he'd been through the Jewish Sanhedrin trial, sort of, and now the Romans have been brought in, and we're looking at their involvement. Jesus is now again taken bound to Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor. And though they had condemned Jesus to death, the Sanhedrin really didn't have the power to execute him. They had to have the approval of the Roman government to carry out an execution. In fact, they had to have the Roman government executing him because they were limited in that by the Romans. Yet this pagan culture did not regard blasphemy, which was the only charge that they could find against Jesus. Blasphemy wasn't a big deal to them. So at least not with the same degree of seriousness. So the charges had to be changed to seditious implications, alleging that Jesus refused to pay the taxes, which we've already looked at that in Luke, that he didn't refuse to pay them. He just said, render unto Caesar the things of the Caesars. Also, his claim of being a king of the Jews, we're about to see that that was bogus too, as he presents his case before Pilate. When Jesus was taken to Pilate in the palace of the governor, the Jews did not enter to avoid becoming unclean, according to Jewish law, at least the way they had built it up. They weren't allowed to enter into a Gentile home, and that would leave them unclean for the Passover. So they actually made the governor come out to them in the dead of night to look what was going on. When asked what the charges were, and I love this part, the Jewish rulers state that they would not have brought Jesus to him if Jesus were not a criminal. It's kind of a weird logic that they got going here. This is the charges. We brought him to you because he's a criminal. And you can see Pilate going, well, what are the charges? Well, the charges are we brought him to you because he's a criminal. Yeah, how often could that go around and around till Pilate, you know, discovered there's nothing going on here? But when Pilate tells them to take him and try him themselves, they object because they want him executed, which they cannot do by Roman law. This was a fulfillment of all that Jesus has spoken up to this point. As we've been going through Luke, we've noticed that in other books, you know, the other Gospels, there are times when Jesus says, I'm on my way to Jerusalem, I'm going to be arrested. Yeah, it's going to be a bogus charge. I'm going to be executed. I mean, he's already told all of this. It's already been prophesied by the Lord himself. The governor takes Jesus in and questions him. When asked if he is indeed a king, Jesus confirms it, but also explains that the kingdom is a spiritual one, intimating that it does not oppose Caesar in any way. Pilate takes him back out and tells the Jews that he can find no basis for the charges against him. Notice, he's acquitted by a Roman court or by the Roman governor. No charges. When the chief priests and elders again charged Jesus, Jesus made no reply. This astonishes Pilate, implying again that the accusations were too absurd to justify an answer. In fact, that's a kind of proverb that in the Old Testament, you don't answer a fool according to his folly. And Jesus, you know, kind of looking at all these charges are foolish. So why answer them? Why give any dignity to the proceedings? The Jews insist on Jesus' death, charging him of stirring up the people from Galilee to Jerusalem. Upon hearing this, Pilate asks Jesus if he is indeed a Galilean. And Jesus assures him that he is. So Pilate sends Jesus to Herod, who is also in Jerusalem at the time. This is Herod Antipas, who had John the Baptist beheaded. Got a little picture on this one. At first, Herod is delighted to see him, for he has longed to see Jesus perform some miracle, which he's been hearing him do all over his own territory. Jesus ignores him and his many questions, while all the time the Jewish rulers are vehemently accusing him. Jesus is then mocked and ridiculed by the king and his soldiers. Okay, he is dressed in an elegant robe and is sent back to Pilate. That day, it says strangely, Herod and Pilate became friends. As Jesus now stands before Pilate in judgment, Pilate's wife sends the governor a warning. Do not have anything to do with that innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him. So Pilate's wife is really concerned about the charges that are going to be brought to Jesus. It's concerned that it's going to fall back on her husband. Pilate then calls the chief priests, the rulers, and the people together and announces, "You brought me this man as one who was inciting the people to rebellion. I have examined him in your presence and have found no basis for your charges against him." That's the second time. You see, there's no Roman charges against him. Neither has Herod, even their own king, has looked to see what was going on and could find nothing wrong with his life. "For he sent him back to us. As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and release him." Pilate is actually looking for a way to get Jesus out of the situation. And when the custom of the upcoming feast is called to his attention, he asks the crowd if they would like to have Jesus released. This is the custom of this feast, that they can request one person to be released from jail. And so Pilate figures, well, they got nothing wrong with this guy. Perhaps they'll just set him loose and that'll be the end of it. They are so stirred up, though, by the Jewish rulers that they actually request the known insurrectionist and murderer, Barabbas, to be released instead. Now, how can all this kind of stuff go on? There's pressures being brought for all this erroneous things to have this, bad course of playing out. There are background reasons as to why no one is behaving the way they should. The chief priests are not really qualified for their office. At this period of time, before the Romans were even there, the Syrians were predominantly in control of Palestine. And it began there where the office of the high priest was a bought position. That Annas that we looked at and Caiaphas, they're not really in the line of high priests. They're not appointed by God. They're not even of the lineage. They've just presented to the Syrians and now the Romans, this is what we'll do for you. Temple funds will be paid to you if you put us in this position. So this is why they're acting inappropriate to what they're doing. Many of these are Sadducees, although we're seeing in Luke that even the Pharisees were caught up in the lust for money and power. And so they've got their own ulterior motives as to what's going on here. The Jews' king, Herod, is not even a Jew. He's an Idumean, which means he comes from Edom, which has been kind of a should have been a brother, but a natural enemy to Israel for, many decades now, centuries. And now he's their king. The people themselves are frustrated with Roman rule and fomented by their teachers into revolts constantly. Pilate wants to placate the Jews so that problems are kept to a minimum. Why is Pilate behaving like this? This is a Roman governor. He's got all these mercenaries working for him, which are hardened criminals, hardened soldiers from all sorts of countries. Why is he backstepping for these Jews who that are under him? Well, there's a historical reason for that too. It might remind Caesar that Pilate was appointed by Mark Antony, who is now considered a traitor to Rome. Okay, so he doesn't want that brought back up into the court of Caesar. So one might argue that all this is according to the providence of God, that God brought all this pressure on to make these people behave in a way they normally wouldn't behave in order for the circumstances to be ripe for the prophecies to be fulfilled throughout the Old Testament. This is the abandonment of Jewish laws, the insanity of the people, and the cowardly conduct of the Roman procurator. Pilate sincerely wanted to release Jesus, but the crowds kept demanding that he be put to death. In desperation, Pilate finally took Jesus and had him flogged. The process of flogging involved bending the victim over a wheel to stretch out the skin and the muscles of the back, and then he was tortured with a leather whip of 9 tails. On each tail was affixed either a very sharp bone or a jagged piece of metal. The amount of lashes was limited because this kind of punishment could easily kill an individual. Weakened with pain and loss of blood, Jesus is then taken into the praetorium and surrounded by Roman soldiers. He is stripped naked and in derision. A scarlet robe is hung on his shoulders, and a mock crown of thorns is placed on his head. They placed a staff in his hands and knelt before him to ridicule him as the king of the Jews. They then spit on him and struck him with a staff. Pilate once more presents Jesus to the crowds to demonstrate the humiliation, hoping that it would pacify the people. But they only begin to cry out, "Crucify, crucify." Then the multitude tells Pilate of Jesus' claim to be the Son of God, and the governor becomes afraid. I know it's because of the people being riled up or into a fevered pitch, or the fact that he might definitely have the Son of God on the podium with him. Jesus, again, refuses to answer any more of Pilate's questions, except to tell him that the power the governor has been given to him from above. Jesus himself brings God into this. Jesus' calmness is unnerving to the procurator. Pilate tries to set Jesus free, but the crowd begins to question his loyalty to Caesar, a loyalty the crowd itself feigns or fakes. It is the last straw. The governor sits upon the stone pavement that is Gabbatha in Aramaic and says, "Here is your king." They respond, "We have no king but Caesar." These are the very people that have been revolting against Caesar ever since he took over. And thus Pilate washes his hands of the whole thing. Barabbas is released. Jesus is let out carrying the top piece of his own cross. At some point, due to the weakness from loss of blood, Simon of Cyrene is impressed to help him carry the cross. At this point, we come to the ordeal of crucifixion. And we're going to make a point of some point of this, but not too much. It is just before noon on Friday when the procession reaches the little hill called Golgotha, the skull, just outside of Jerusalem. Jesus is nailed to a wooden cross and raised up between two criminals. The crowd he looks upon is mixed, consisting of those in sorrow who are his family and followers, and those soldiers who continue to mock him, accompanied by the jeers and laughters of those who demand his death. He asks the Father to forgive them, for they know not what they're doing. It is now crawling past the third hour, or noon. Pilate has a plaque prepared to hang over him. It reads, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." It is written in Aramaic, Greek, and Latin. The Jewish rulers object to the wording, but Pilate, in his anger, lets it stand as is. The soldiers cast lots for his clothing. It is a fulfillment of Psalms 22. The crowd, composed of chief priests and elders, continues to ridicule Jesus, challenging him to come down or to call upon the Father to save him, if he truly is the Son of God. The soldiers continue to mock him, calling upon him also to save himself, if he truly is the King of the Jews. You might say it's almost the last straw. Even one of the criminals beside him is still deriding him. The other, however, seems to be one of the first to realize something different is going on, and ask Jesus to remember him in his kingdom. It is mid-afternoon, the sixth hour, and the world becomes aware that it has gone too far. Darkness comes over the land. It's not an apocalypse. As Africanus points out, it's the time of the full moon. What do they call it? The Paschal full moon? Yeah, if you know your astronomy, when you got a full moon, you can't have an eclipse. The moon's on the wrong side of the Earth. But the eclipse lasts for 3 hours. Jesus calls out to the Father, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Psalms 22 is being quoted. He's not saying that God has forsaken him. What he's done, and we've just pointed this out recently in a sermon, he's calling attention to Psalms 22, which has already been pointed out, the casting of lots for his clothes. Psalms 22, every Jew knows. And they know the events of the psalm by heart. And they know now that he's pointing out to them, and they all realize it, that he's fulfilling prophecy. A lot of prophecy. It gives specific details of the things that the multitude could see being done that were a fulfillment of what the scriptures predicted and could not be denied. It proved Jesus was who he claimed to be. It is also a psalm, though, of hope and trust. For the writer knows the Father will come to his aid and not abandon him. So Jesus knew he was not going to be abandoned. His Father would look out for him. The ordeal is taking its toll. The pain is worsening. Jesus asks for the drink, finally saying, it is finished. Then, with a loud voice, he says, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And the Son of Man dies. I've structured it that way, Son of Man. He's claimed to be the Son of Man through all of this. The Son of God does not die. He lives on. Even the Son of Man is going to return. But notice this. At the moment, momentous things are occurring to let the world know this truly was the Son of God. At the moment of his death, the earth shakes, the rocks split, the tombs break open, and many of the holy dead are raised up. After Jesus' resurrection, they go back into the city. Can you imagine the spectacle? All these people that they have been burying for a while are suddenly coming back into their presence, alive, just the way they were. The heavy curtain in the temple separating the holy place from the most holy is torn in two from its top to its bottom. This is no mean feat. This curtain is heavy. It's a well-embroidered tapestry with even some metal threads in it, indicating, though, that men will now have direct access to the Father and no longer have to go through their priests or the high priest. The centurions guarding Jesus are terrified. They said, these are battle-hardened men. These men have been in battle in places in far regions of the Roman Empire. They've seen some things. But even this is getting to them. One of them says, surely this was the Son of God. What an incredible admission to make by a Roman. Another passage, and we pointed this out last week, has the Romans saying, truly this was an innocent man. It's not a contradiction, because as we pointed out, the only charge was that he claimed to be the Son of God. Now, if he's innocent of that charge, then blasphemy is not really viable here, and he is who he claims to be. As an innocent man, he's the Son of God. Many of the people who had come to witness beat their breasts in realization of what they have done. This was also prophesied, the effect it would have on the people. And the effect is because of Psalms 22. Jesus, as they had been calling for his crucifixion, now they realize what they've done. And they scatter. The evening of the Sabbath approaches, and those being crucified will have their legs broken so that they will die of suffocation. But when the soldier pierced Jesus' side, it was evident that it was already dead, for there came forth both blood and water. The Apostle John testifies to this, that Jesus was pierced and his bones not broken also fulfills Scripture. Those in Numbers, Psalms, Zechariah, and others. Now, at this point, I want to break off. Preachers usually dwell on how severe the pain of the nails, along with the cramps from the contortion of leg muscles and the scourging that hastened his death. But it's interesting that the gospel writers themselves don't dwell on any of this. And this kind of leads into, you know, the next sections. They give no detail to describe the Lord's physical sufferings because there's more important issues involved than just his physical sufferings. Okay. The sacrifice was for a purpose. And this is a purpose that we need to explore more in the coming presentations. But for now, one thing I would like to point out as an invitation here. Because we just got through covering this in Luke. And Jesus talks about us taking up our own cross and following him. And it follows this. He talks about hatred. And in some cases, it's loving less. But in this context, it goes, he has to hate his own life. And it's not telling you to commit suicide. By a context, an implication of knowing the character and teachings of God. What Jesus is saying is, as you look at your life, the worldliness you find in there, you have to hate. Even if you find it in relatives or friends or something like that, that worldliness has to be something that you absolutely abhor, as God does. If you try to reason it out or make excuses for it so that you can retain it, you've got a serious problem. Jesus says those things, if you're truly going to be a disciple, okay, you're going to have to get rid of with the same kind of agony that he suffered on the cross. That is, it's going to be, think of a person who's on drugs and now decides to go clean. If they aren't in a hospital situation, where they're slowly being medicated through the process to kind of help them along. If they just go cold turkey, you can hear their screams at night as they're shaking, as they can feel the pain, the searing agony coursing through their body. It's almost like being crucified. But the person will go through that when they finally realize, this is what my sin has done. This is what my addiction has done. It's cost me my relationship with my God. It's cost me my own health, body, mind, and soul. It's cost me relationships with my friends and family. What are you willing to do to get rid of it? And Jesus says, it's like being hung on a cross. You've got to be willing like he was to get rid of your worldliness in order to be a true disciple. And that's what he invites us to do. He says, if you really want to follow him, are you willing to get all the things that keep you from God out of your life? I mean, are you really serious about it? Do you really want a very personal relationship with your Creator? Do you want God helping you along in life, instructing you, showing you how to make it a better world and how to enter into a better world to come, or an even better world to come? What are you willing to do? And this is one of the reasons why we get in the implications of his crucifixion, but why was he willing to go there? If nothing else, to give us an example of how far we need to go, if we have to, in order to get rid of the effects of the world on our lives and on our hearts. I mean, if you can sit here and say, well, there's nothing wrong with me, you've already got a serious problem. Because Paul's already told us, we're all sinned. We've sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. If we are not glorious as God meant us to be from the very beginning, as glorious as his Son, who's willing to the point of death to be obedient to the Father, then we're not there yet. But we do have help. We have the Scriptures for help. We have the ability to go to God in prayer for help. We have the church that God, that Christ came and died for, to give us fellow Christian family and people that can help support us through the worst of trial. This is what God invites you to, and don't take it for granted, especially if you've grown up in the church. When you get out in the world, you realize the world has none of that, and it has no hope. you have something very precious as being a child of God, of being a disciple, a true disciple, who is willing to do anything in order to be right with his Maker. If there's anything we can do to help this very hour, please let us know as we stand to sing.